This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A Granite State Grizzly hangs on, a huge upset in New York, an even bigger shocker in Delaware. It's Wednesday and time for a Tea for Two edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
In the last big wave of primaries, the Tea Party wins big battles in Republican primaries in the First and Empire States. A squeaker in New Hampshire, two embattled Democrats survive tests in House races in New York, and congressional Republicans split on the Bush tax cuts. That's okay, the Democrats do too. In a bit, we'll focus on New York and New Hampshire. Later in the program, the Jim Crow era guide for the African-American traveler, Julian Bond, will join us to talk about the Green Book. But first, and political junkie Ken Rudin is visiting our member station in St. Louis, KWMU, so we've asked NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving to fill in, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. Ron, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And we have to start in the second smallest state in the union, a tremendous shocker in Delaware.
Delaware is the first state because they were the first ones to vote for the Constitution. And the Tea Party folks, who like to talk about the Constitution quite a bit, are going to have a lot of bragging rights for at least a period of time because Christine O'Donnell, the longest of long shots, perennial candidate there in Delaware and somebody who has been pretty thoroughly defeated when she's run before for statewide office, suddenly defeated the man who, more than anyone else, I think you could say, embodied the establishment in Delaware as a moderate Republican, first elected to the state legislature in 1966, Mike Castle. And for the last 40 years, he has been lieutenant governor, governor, and the sole House member from the state, usually being reelected by 65%. In his last election in 2008, he got 250,000-some votes in being sent back to Congress. And yet, yesterday, in a very low turnout primary, he got about 27,000 votes, and Christine O'Donnell got about 30,500 votes, and in that sense, comfortably, defeated him and defeated the establishment of Delaware.
Now, this is a race where, had he won the nomination, Mike Castle was considered a prohibitive favorite to win the seat, once occupied by now Vice President Joe Biden. Ted Kaufman inherited the seat by appointment when Biden was elected to the vice presidency, and Kaufman vowed not to run. Initially thought he was holding it for Beau Biden, but the vice president's son decided not to run for re-election. He's the attorney general there. In any case, this is a state where Mike Castle, a moderate Republican, a what conservatives called a rhino, a Republican in name only, was thought to have a prohibitive edge over the Democratic rival. Nevertheless, with the nomination yesterday of Ms. O'Donnell, well, no less a person than Karl Rove told Sean Hannity on Fox News that there are all sorts of questions about her, why she didn't pay back her college loans, how she makes a living, how she spends her campaign money, and concluded this.
I'm for the Republican, but I got to tell you, we were looking at 8 to 9 seats in the Senate. We're now looking at 7 to 8, in my opinion. This is not a race we're going to be able to win, in my opinion.
Not a race we're going to be able to win, a conclusion that apparently the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee came to as well.
And one that the Delaware Republican Party has been saying all through the weekend and in robocalls and trying to alert people to who Christine O'Donnell was, many people really didn't know. Many people, I think, were turning out to cast a protest vote against the Delaware Republican Party, perhaps against the establishment of both parties, against everything they see happening in Washington, against the health care bill, perhaps against the bailout of the banks back in 2008. And she was the vehicle for that protest vote. Now, Mike Castle himself has always been personally popular. He's close to a lot of people in politics in both parties in the state. And as you said, when he announced that he was going to run, begged to run, of course, by the Republican National Senate Committee, when he announced run, everybody just said, well, you watch now, Beau Biden's going to step back. And as you say, Beau Biden did step back. And everyone else stepped back and said, well, that's Mike Castle's seat. And everyone thought it would be until the last several weeks. And let's give Joe Miller credit out in Alaska.
Sure.
Let's give the Tea Party Express credit.
Sharon
they came
Engel
in
as well.
At the last minute, spent at least $230,000. Jim DeMint, the conservative senator from South Carolina, came in and said Christine O'Donnell was just fine with him. And, of course, let's not leave her out, Sarah Palin weighed in and said, I like Christine O'Donnell, and of course a lot of people had already noticed that she was kind of a bit of a sound-alike, look-alike for Sarah Palin, and boom, it can happen.
And it can happen also now for Christopher Coons, the county executive of one of the three
Newcastle County,
the Wilmington County, the big population county in the state of Delaware, and somebody who was thought to be running on the Democratic side unopposed for and also ran.
As a sacrificial lamb. I think he probably would have been the first person to tell you 2 or 3 weeks ago that that was his function. And then, of course, it started to loom up that this extraordinary energy, as we saw Joe Miller winning in Alaska over Lisa Murkowski and other places around the country, really, Utah, Nevada, Kentucky, Colorado, these are all places where Tea Party candidates have displaced better-known establishment Republican candidates with long electoral histories, or at least with superior ones to the Tea Party challengers. And in this particular instance, it seemed like a bridge too far, but as it turned out, there was such a small turnout, there were so few people involved, that the enthusiasm of the Tea Party enthusiasts was enough to pull this extraordinary upset. Now Chris Coons becomes installed overnight as the favorite to hold the seat. You heard Karl Rove.
All right, let's go to, well, before we leave Delaware, a congressional seat, the one congressional seat, in that state, also up in an interesting race for that as well, to succeed Mike Castle.
That's right, and this is one of those very few seats around the country that the Democrats thought that they had a pretty good chance of picking up because they thought they would have a more popular candidate. But there was a contest between an establishment Republican here and an activist, and it appears that we're down to about 500 votes, but it appears that the activist candidate, the Tea Party preferred candidate, is going to be the winner there. Still to be finally determined.
Too close to call. We will focus later, as we mentioned, on the primaries in New York State and in the primary in the state of New Hampshire. Again, very interesting results there. But there were some others around the rest of the country yesterday. And, well, here in the Washington, the District of Columbia, the reformist Mayor Adrian Fenty, elected 4 years ago, ousted.
Elected 4 years ago in every ward and every voting precinct of the city. He really threaded the needle of the complicated racial politics of Washington, D.C., the complicated reform versus old-style Democratic politics of Washington, D.C., and seemed to have everyone behind him. But over the last 4 years, he's done a lot of things that in some cases were seen as reformist, in other cases were seen as favoring his own friends and cronies, giving contracts to them, fighting with the city council, being in constant conflict with the people on the city council, who were eventually represented by Vince Gray, who was the nominee against him, who soundly defeated him. So after 4 years, this person who was thought to be mayor for life, this person who was going to completely change the politics of Washington, D.C., has been spanked and dismissed by the voters. Also, we should also say that he is an African-American, as was his opponent, but he lost badly the most African-American wards in the city. Overall, I believe about two-thirds of the black vote went against him. So while he still was doing all right west of the park and in those parts of the city that are Hispanic and Anglo, he had really lost the base of the African-American community in Washington, D.C., and that's why he's lost.
In Maryland, next door to Delaware, I don't think Maryland ever heard it described that way ever before, it's going to be a rematch for the gubernatorial race. The current mayor, Mr. O'Malley, running against his predecessor, Mr. Ehrlich. That was all expected. No big surprises there. Anything else that we should be looking at in the primaries that were held yesterday?
Well, back in Wisconsin, there was a contest between Scott Walker, the county executive of Milwaukee County, who is a Republican, against Mark Newman, a former congressman from Wisconsin. Back in the 1990s, he was part of that mid-90s energy that was so strong, a very orthodox conservative running against Scott Walker from the right in the contest for the gubernatorial nomination in Wisconsin, which this year is looking toward the Republican Party in a lot of ways. And so the Republicans are feeling very strong about their chances there. Scott Walker held off Mark Newman, his challenger, and will be the Republican nominee there.
In the meantime, the Congress returned to Washington, D.C. after the summer recess. I think rather reluctantly. They always prefer to be at home at this particular time of the year in an election year. But in any case, the big issue is going to be the fate of the Bush tax cuts. And there are basically two tiers of this tax cut progress that program that we're going to be talking about. One is for most people, and it's described as the middle class tax cut. In other words, provides tax cuts for everybody, households making up to $250,000 a year. The remainder is for those, that 2% of the country that earns over $250,000 a year in tax cuts. And it was interesting that at the beginning of this week, in an appearance on Face the Nation, the Republican minority leader in the House of Representatives, John Boehner, indicated, well, President Obama wants to keep the middle class tax cut, keep that, and then eliminate the tax cut for the wealthy. And if it comes down to it, he'll go along with that.
If the only option I have is to vote for some of those tax reductions, I'll vote for him.
I'll vote for them. But then we had his counterpart in the United States Senate, the minority leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, introduce a package that preserves all of the tax cuts. And he went on to the Senate floor to say, not only is are the Republicans going to vote for it, he's got some allies.
The good news is there's a growing chorus of Democrats, including at least five right here in the Senate, are coming around on this issue. They oppose the tax hikes the administration is proposing. As Senator Lieberman put it earlier just today, I don't think it makes sense to raise any federal taxes during the uncertain economy we are struggling through.
And this indicates, sort of ignores the fact there's more than a few Republicans who are willing to vote for the Democrats.
It all depends on how the question is posed. If you say to people, including to senators and congressmen, are you in favor of tax cuts for everybody? It's pretty easy to say yes. Or in this particular instance, are you in favor of extending tax cuts that were passed nearly a decade ago for everybody? It's pretty easy to say yes. If you frame it the other way and say, how would you feel about tax cuts for everybody except the richest 2 or 3%, except for people over $250,000 a year? Then when you start putting the figures to it of how much money that costs the federal treasury, something like $700 billion over the next 10 years, and what that does to the deficit, then you get more of a mixed opinion. And John Boehner was answering the hypothetical of, would you hold out for the last 2 or 3%, even if it meant no tax cuts for the 97%? That's a tougher question for a Republican to answer.
And it looks like it's going to be an interesting question that's going to be posed both ways, well, from now until probably January 1st. Stay tuned. More with Ron Elving in just a moment. We're going to continue with the political junkie. And how often do you get to introduce Perry Como?
She died in misery, boy, she died in misery. Oh, what did Delaware, boy, what did Delaware? What did Delaware, boy, what did
We look for these cuts everywhere. Stay tuned. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Another big primary day yesterday. All of it great fodder for our political junkie segment. Now you know why we talk politics on Wednesdays. Ron Elving is with us today, NPR senior Washington editor, a prolific blogger and podcaster, too. And Ron, with all the upstarts this political season winning, NPR has some new political blogs up and running. Is this just for the remainder of the election season?
It's all politics.
Hold on just a second. Go ahead.
It's All Politics is what we're calling this section of the NPR website, npr.org. And Frank James is turning his considerable blogging talents away from the daily news for the rest of the election season to give us the daily update, the hour-by-hour update on who's won and who's ahead and who's losing and what's coming next. In addition to that, of course, Ken Rudin's ever-popular Political Junkie, which he's been doing for a number of years with his button puzzle, will be available right there on that same site, as well as the Watching Washington column that I write.
So go to npr.org and click on Politics.
Politics.
Okay.
Also, you can access the It's All Politics podcast the same way each week.
And we should note yesterday's big wave, the last big day of primaries, but there's still some business to clean up in Hawaii and Louisiana as well. So we'll have news from that when we get Ken Rudin back. As we mentioned earlier, he's out visiting our member station in St. Louis. And of course, yesterday's primaries may be a preview of what's to come in November's midterm elections. Polls show that insiders are often on the outs with voters, but we've also seen there's no obvious script this time around. If you're in New York or New Hampshire, call and tell us what lessons you take from yesterday's primary results. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email, talk@npr.org. And you can go to that website, npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Join the conversation that way. Andy Smith is director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center and an associate professor of political science there with us from the University of New Hampshire campus in Durham. Nice to have you with us today.
Good afternoon.
And we understand there's been a certified winner now in the New New Hampshire gubernatorial Senate nomination.
Yes, Kelly Ayotte has been certified the winner. However, the margin is close enough that there's very likely to be a recount, and we really won't know the results of that recount until Friday.
A recount, and are they going to have to go to absentee ballots, that sort of thing?
I believe so, yes. They'll go back and count all of the ballots.
And what's the analysis? Her primary challenger was Ovid LaMontagne, perhaps a little bit more conservative than she is, but she was the Granite Grizzly, after all.
Yeah, this was an interesting race because it really showed that the Tea Party is not as effective in a state like New Hampshire as it may be in other places. Here you had the Tea Party largely splitting its endorsement, Sarah Palin going after Kelly Ayotte, and who's seen as more of the establishment candidate here, and Ovid LaMontagne, who ran for governor back in 1996 and who's been really part of the Republican establishment in the state for years, running as the Tea Party candidate. Both of them are largely conservative. I think this came down to a matter of turnout. Turnout was not as high as expected here, and I think because the lower turnout meant that the most conservative voters were out voting, I think that helped LaMontagne and made this race as close as it was.
Low turnout, we'd been hearing about all the energy in Republican primaries across the country this year.
Well, I think that points out about the Tea Party in New Hampshire. If you think of the Tea Party as having fiscal wings and socially conservative wings, on the fiscally conservative side, everybody in New Hampshire is fiscally conservative. It kind of goes without saying, particularly among Republicans. And on the socially conservative side, that energy just isn't here in a state like New Hampshire. We've got the second least religious state in the country. Republicans here are by and large pro-choice. We had legalized gay marriage through the legislative process, and Republicans really didn't seem to mind that much at all. So we don't have that energy that the Tea Party has demonstrated in other parts of the country.
And as you look at the race come November, the Democrat hoping to take that Senate seat is Paul Hodes, the congressman. He ran unopposed in the primary. How does this shape up?
Well, assuming that it's Kelly Ayotte, I think this is probably her. She has to be seen as the favorite. She's been leading him in head-to-head matchups over the last year. And Paul Hodes starts off with significant disadvantages in that he's not particularly popular among people in the states. His net favorability ratings in the state have hovered around zero, meaning equal numbers of people have an unfavorable opinion as a favorable opinion of him. And in a strongly pro-Republican year, as we're seeing across the country, and we do see that Republicans have the energy here in the state, it's going to be tough for him to pull this one out.
Okay. And what lesson do you take away from especially the more interesting race, the Republican primary?
Well, a couple things. First off, that primaries are different and that voters really pay attention at the very end of the race. I think this is where LaMontagne marshaled his resources to the end. He didn't have that much money. He put on TV ads only over the last week. He performed extremely well in the final debate last Thursday, and he got the endorsement of the union leader. And when voters finally started paying attention to this race after Labor Day, those are the things that Republicans were seeing, and I think that helped him out. A second lesson, I think, is that you should play nice. Don't get involved in nasty, negative TV battles. Bill Binney, who is the Republican that we haven't talked about here, was often seen as a favorite or certainly the number two person to Ayotte through much of the summer, but he went negative, and he ended up finishing in a distant third, I think, because voters don't like to see those negative battles.
As you look at, well, of course, and Ovid LaMontagne did well because he came on the Political Junkie when we were in New Hampshire.
That must explain all of it.
Must have been the turning point to his campaign. It really caught fire at that point. But as we look ahead to the race in November, the political climate, as you say, may favor Republicans. How is Kelly Ayotte as a campaigner?
She's still a little stiff. She doesn't have that personal warmth and charisma that a more seasoned campaigner would have. And I think that was really obvious against Ovid LaMontagne, who just exudes charisma when he's on the stage and in person as well. I think she has to do a better job. I think when debates come up between her and Paul Hodes, she's going to have to be more comfortable in front of people and on television. But, running for office is a tough thing. She's never run before. She had been a prosecutor. And prosecutors have a tendency not to be particularly good candidates because they have to be so guarded with the language that they use. So she has some loosening up to do, I think, on the campaign trail. But she only has about 6 weeks to do it.
Andy Smith, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center and associate professor of political science, and joined us from the University of New Hampshire campus in Durham. And let's turn now to New York State. Mickey Carroll is a director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, a veteran political writer and columnist, and he joins us from his home in New York City. Mickey, nice of you to be with us today.
Well, how you doing? Big election day yesterday.
Big election day, and no bigger than in the Republican gubernatorial primary.
Well, I'll tell you, that loud slurping sound you heard was the Republican Party in New York, as we know it, going right down the drain. The guy who won is he's an interesting guy. Paladino. He's an interesting guy. He's a says what he thinks. Got a lot of money. Blah 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 blah. But the Republican establishment was totally against him, and he's got a history of saying stuff that can get him in trouble. So it'll be, you know, he'll at least be sort of fun.
Well, the man he defeated, former Congressman Lazio, again anointed the candidate by the Republican establishment. What was left of it in the state of New York after the
not much
after the destruction 2 years ago and 4 years ago, thought to be the most credible statewide candidate of all the statewide candidates.
Well, the Quinnipiac polls have shown that so far, at least, that either one of them, Lazio or Paladino, would lose 2-1. To Andrew Cuomo. Now, let's find out what happens after the dust settles. We'll do another poll and find out. But Cuomo is the far and away favorite. And, no matter which one of them, the thing about Paladino is he at least might make it more interesting. Lazio, a mainstream Republican and a very nice guy and so forth, but not exactly charismatic.
Well, let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. New Yorkers, what lessons do you draw from the primary yesterday? Vivian's on the line from Setauket.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a legislator here in Suffolk County. And so I watched this with great interest. And actually, Rick Lazio is a lackluster campaigner. And Paladino was certainly rather extreme, so I think the Republicans have really a large battle ahead of them with this race.
You got a point, Vivian. The Paladino is a, whether he's a good candidate or not, he is certainly a noticeable candidate. He'll cause a stir.
He was talking in his victory speech yesterday about those Republicans who opposed me can join the People's Revolution.
Well, good.
Yes, it worked. Budget 20% and cutting tax by 10%. Interesting.
what is his background, Mickey? Thanks very much for the call, Vivian. Said to be a Buffalo businessman.
Yeah, he is. He's a businessman and a very conservative guy. He's given a lot of money to politicians. Of both parties, actually, but he's never been a candidate before, to my knowledge. He's a mostly in a real estate business, and he, it's funny, he has a sort of barn burner image, and yet when you see him, he's quite a plausible, amiable guy to listen to. He has a good television presence, but on the other hand, Andrew Cuomo is in not only the Quinnipiac poll, every politician says Andrew Cuomo has it virtually sewed up. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, we've been wrong before calling
yes,
people
indeed.
Sewn up. There is a an appointed Democrat who's serving out the remainder of Hillary Clinton's term, Kirsten Gillibrand. She has to run for election this time around and then again 2 years later. But, well, we've seen appointed senators in Colorado, for example, pretty vulnerable. Who are the Republicans putting up against Kirsten Gillibrand?
Joseph DiAguardi, former congressman. And the thing about Gillibrand, she's appointed. She was vulnerable, very definitely vulnerable from the Democratic left, which is always where trouble comes
for the Democrats
in politics. But Chuck Schumer, the senator, the senior senator, managed to head off every possible liberal challenger to her in the Democratic primary. So that she's now confronting a Republican, and the idea that anybody could sort of out conservative the Gillibrand, it's a tough one to do. So anyway, it'll be a DiAguardi Gillibrand who looked vulnerable from the left, now will be challenged from the Republican, I guess the Republican right, you'd call it. And Schumer is the who has a terrific record on picking winners and making sure that they win He engineered this.
Well, let's stay on the Democratic side for just a moment. The former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Charlie Rangel in Harlem, was thought to be, well, he's facing a lot of ethics charges in Congress and thought to be vulnerable running amongst other people against the son of his predecessor.
He was very weak on the editorial pages, but they love him in Harlem. There was a five-way primary. And toward the end, Rangel did a couple of things that you sort of have to say, wow, that's a show. On the final Sunday before the election, he went to the Abyssinian Baptist Church, which, of course, was Adam Clayton Powell's pulpit. And Charlie Rangel went and received an ovation and blah, 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 blah. He also said that Adam Clayton Powell, the son of the congressman, the son of the congressman that he beat 40 mm-hmm. years ago, he said that, and I don't quote him exactly, but it was sort of one of he said Adam Clayton Powell Jr. He said was God gave him a handsome face and a great name, and then God stopped. Rangel was weak on the editorial pages, stuff like that, but in that district, he had it pretty well sewed up, and then one going away.
We're talking with Mickey Carroll of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, with us from his home in New York. It's the Political Junkie on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we go to another caller. This is William. William with us on the line from Buffalo.
Hi, this is William, first-time caller.
Go ahead, please.
I was watching the polls yesterday, and I've been concerned about Palladino since he started running. Some of the racial comments that he's made about the president and the things that he was running as far as his platform is concerned with the prisons for poor people and some of the comments that he was making about wanting to teach poor people hygiene and things of that nature has really raised a concern, at least to me and a lot of the people that I speak with.
What kind of racial comments about the president are you talking about?
Well, he had emails that he was forwarding, and that they've met the media where he had an African dancer, and he was saying that was the president's inauguration dance. And then he had some pictures that he had passed around that somebody had doctored and put the president and the first lady's face on a pimp and one of his working ladies.
William, there was no doubt, William, that Palladino has a record that the Cuomo people, I am sure, are salivating over. He's done a lot of stuff. But I remember in your town, Buffalo, Bob McCarthy from the Buffalo News, is an excellent reporter, told me, we talked 3 or 4 months ago when Palladino hardly showed up on the screens. He said, watch out for this guy. He's a real candidate, and of course he turned out to be a real candidate.
And here's an email from Thad, also in Buffalo. He's an attorney as well as a developer, a self-made man. He's a character, but shrewd. I'm a Dem, and I'm voting for him.
Well, that's a tribute.
William, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Before we leave you, Mickey, there is also Republicans, again, after the wreckage 2 years ago, hope to get 4, 5, maybe on the outside 6 congressional seats from the state of New York. How do their prospects
it's
look today?
Possible. You know, the three candidates ran to go against Bishop. It's hard to say. The political writers, what I used to be, what I'm not anymore, so I'm not plugged into it, you know, the way I used to be when I was writing this stuff. They say that McMahon down in Staten Island's in trouble. I don't know. I'd take a look at that district up along the St. Lawrence where they had it was Republican from the Civil War days.
Oh, this is Eric Mass's old seat.
Yes, exactly.
The tickler.
Exactly. And so, but I don't know. The Republicans, nationally, there's no doubt there's a throw the bums out kind of thing. There's a get rid of the incumbents. There's some sort of a swelling against Republicans nationally. But in New York State, the Republican Party hardly exists. And the leadership took a whacking, took a solid pasting from Palladino. Palladino ran against the Republican leadership in New York, and he beat him. Now, obviously, the question is, there's a lot of questions, but as far as the party itself, Will they win some state senate seats? Will they win some congressional seats? Will they maybe even win one of the attorney general or the controller race statewide? Maybe, but if they do, it'll be the candidates who do it because the party is in the dumps.
Mickey Carroll, thanks very much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Mickey Carroll, director of the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute, a veteran political watcher in New York. He joined us from his home in New York City. We thank Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, for filling in for the political junkie Ken Rudin. We expect him back next week, whether we want him or not. Stay with us. We're going to be talking about a little remembered piece of America's racially charged past. This is NPR News.